This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Of all the facial features, the nose is perhaps the most maligned. It's the most popular choice for plastic surgery and for jokes. Is that a nose or did a bus park on your face? And then there's the plumbing angle. The physiology of the nose and the sinus passages is a subject most people would avoid in polite company. But not today. Throughout her life, journalist Gabrielle Glaser has had a troubled relationship with her own nose. Now she's written a book about the history, the culture, and the biology of the olfactory organ. It's called The Nose, A Profile of Sex, Beauty, and Survival. Scientists are developing new theories about what causes sinus problems. When Terry spoke with Gabrielle Glaser, she asked her to describe what the sinuses are.
Sinuses are little cavities that we have behind our noses and lining, actually, the back of our noses that are really very similar to a cluster of grapes. And nobody's really sure why we have them. Some people theorize that they developed when we began walking upright, and it allowed us to hold our heads up more easily with just the brain taking up all that weight and space.
So we don't really know what the heck they're supposed to be doing?
No, well, they equalize barometric pressure. They act as resonance for the voice. They humidify air that's going into the lungs. They, if we're in a hot place, they cool it down. And if we're in a cold place, they keep it, they warm it up. But that's what they do today. Nobody's really sure how it all started.
Unfortunately, sinuses dysfunction a lot of the time. What happens when sinuses go wrong?
Oh, so much happens. You have, inside your sinuses, you have hundreds and hundreds of little cilia, tiny little hair-like filaments that move mucus to the back of your throat and down to your stomach, where pollen and bacteria and viruses generally are swallowed without any notice. People who have healthy sinuses don't even notice these functions. And actually, they produce, if you can believe this, a pint to a quart of mucus a day. But when sinuses dysfunction, and anybody who has a cold or who's had a cold knows this, you know, your nose gets runny, your sinuses fill up, and the cilia become totally overwhelmed, and they can't function anymore, and you get sick. And in the case of people, 37 million people who have a disease called chronic sinusitis, this is a daily, it's just how they live their daily lives.
So when sinuses are malfunctioning, Do the sinuses and does that whole nasal area become the breeding ground for infection?
Yes. The cilia become overwhelmed. You get sinuses that are pocked with inflammation, and little parts of bacteria get trapped, and infection can breed there and grow and make people really, really miserable.
Now, what's the difference between chronic sinus problems and bad allergies?
When you are allergic to something, you have cells in your nose that react to pollen, and they react by sending a fluid. That's what makes your nose itch, and you have a runny nose, and your eyes water, and your throat gets scratchy. These cells become overwhelmed with fluid that is really literally trying to flush the pollen out. And it's easily treatable by a simple antihistamine, and you feel better. And people with chronic sinusitis are not that lucky. They have this dysfunction of their sinus someplace within the cluster of their sinuses, and we have dozens of them. You can have the biggest one is the maxillary sinus. There are sinuses above your forehead that are separated from your brain by one of the thinnest bones in the body. It's really paper thin. You can actually see through it. You can see through the bone to the brain. And you feel just chronically run down. You have a headache. You have this kind of runny nose that's just constant. I once spoke to a woman who had this disease, and she worked in the White House. She worked in the Clinton White House. And she told me, she took me aside, and she said, "What do I do? You know, I've seen all these doctors, and I'll go to these meetings in the Oval Office, and I can't, you know, the president looks at you and talks to you. She was actually his point person on health reform, of all things, way back in the day. And she said, the president looks at you and you've got literally a mouthful of mucus. And you can't very well just take a Kleenex aside and say, sorry, President Clinton, I've got to spit this. And it really, I think that to me was one of the most vivid portrayals of what this is for people. They're self-conscious. Their sex lives get ruined. They become depressed. It's something that's always there. And
yeah, I was interested that you connect sinusitis with depression, fatigue, and a loss of sexual interest.
Yes. People, first of all, your head hurts all the time. And I say, I'm speaking from personal experience. You have, because I you know, struggle along with the ailment myself. And you're always aware that you never quite feel quite right. There have been many studies done on this because doctors are really struggling to try and treat patients for the whole disease, which turns out to be systemic. Many suffer from depression. They suffer from, as you said, loss of sexual interest. They're fatigued all the time. They just feel constantly run down. And when you feel run down all the time, I mean, who knows what comes first, depression or the disease? But at any rate, the majority of people with this disease, and it works out to be about 13% of all Americans, really do report that they also feel depressed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gabrielle Glaser. We're talking about her book, The Nose. Let's look at some of the most common treatments for sinus problems. And common treatments include inhalers that often have some kind of corticosteroid in them. What's the latest thinking on those inhalers?
Well, the latest thinking is that they're fine to use. Millions of people certainly use them, and they cut down the inflammation, which ultimately leads to an infection. But some doctors also believe that they can potentially weaken the membrane, and who knows where people will be, 20, 30 years from now. So not everyone is a big fan of them. A lot of doctors really, really like them, but as with most drugs today, nobody really knows what the outcome will be decades down the line.
What about antibiotics?
Well, antibiotics are certainly used. Billions of dollars are spent on antibiotics to treat sinus infections, and ever more powerful ones are always coming out. And there's always some new great antibiotic that's going to treat this bacteria or this bacteria or this bacteria. But oftentimes, frankly, people with chronic sinusitis grow out all kinds of crazy bacteria because they're constantly switching back and forth from one antibiotic to another. They have literally chronic infections, and they certainly are at risk for, these killer bugs that we hear about.
So, in other words, you think antibiotics can sometimes actually increase the problem over time?
Yes, indeed. But on the other hand, they also have to be used in these patients. It's not a matter of just getting over a cold. These people literally have, bad infections. Their cilia are disabled. They can't get over the infection by themselves. And if you don't treat them, it can result, the ailment can spread to the brain. You can have meningitis, encephalitis. You can have chronic ear infections, and they have to be treated. So, they're looking at new ways to try to tackle this disease without antibiotics.
There are also various surgeries that are performed for people with chronic sinus problems.
Right.
Maybe you could describe the thinking behind those procedures and how effective are they really?
Well, sure. Several years ago, I'd say about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, doctors, the only way to reach the sinuses, which are really very cramped and it's hard to get to them, the only way they could reach the sinuses was to cut a hole through the roof of the mouth and drain the maxillary sinus that way, or make an incision literally in the eyebrow and drain the frontal sinuses that way. And it was quite dangerous, and it was disfiguring. And as you can imagine, patients were, really pretty beat up afterwards. With the with the invention of an endoscope, which is a tubed scope that is lighted at one end and it's attached to a video monitor on the other end, which magnifies what the doctors are seeing on the inside. This gave doctors a new tool to stick the tube up the patient's nose and peer into the sinuses and do, you know, microsurgery inside this tiny little cramped space. And that seemed like that was going to be the answer for people with this disease. And by the way, the numbers are growing. In 1982, I just was reviewing some of these statistics. I think the figure for people with chronic sinusitis was 27 million. And now the figure is 37 million. Some doctors would put it at 40 million. So in 20 years' time, that's a significant bump up. And at any rate, back to these surgical techniques. Doctors were thrilled with these endoscopes. This was going to be the answer, and this disease could be cured this way. And they got a little, too happy with these with some of these procedures, and they started stripping away membranes that shouldn't have been stripped away. They started cutting out something we have called turbinates. You have three sets of them inside your nose, and they are responsible for humidifying the air, which I discussed, you know, when we discussed that earlier. And they're also one of the first lines of defense against bacteria and viruses. And they thought, oh, well, these swell, and they get in the patient's way of breathing. We'll just chop them out. And in fact, oftentimes, the surgery left people more impaired and sicker than they had ever been before. And doctors are now revising their notions of surgery and who needs it and exactly when it needs to be performed. And they are really trying, they really have stepped back in terms of the aggressiveness of their procedures. And some people are, you know, dismayed by the whole notion of surgery altogether, unless a person has an anatomical blockage and something really, really, really needs to be done.
You know, you described how some doctors were taking out the turbinates, leaving patients more defenseless against germs. Is this what's described as empty nose syndrome?
Yes, this is what doctors call empty nose syndrome. And patients are really impaired after this. They find they can't smell. They find they have nerve damage. This is one of the most nerve-dense regions in the entire body. You know, you're right next to your optic nerve. You're right next to your olfactory nerve. There's so much that can go wrong with sinus surgery. And people just simply didn't recognize that when these endoscopes came into view. They thought this was, you know, this was it. This was going to be the answer. And in fact, you know, thousands of people have lost their sense of smell as a result of surgery. I got an email the other day from a woman who does have this empty nose syndrome, who's basically lived the last several years on Vicodin, which is a very potent painkiller. And she said she's seen 15 doctors who have tried to help her. And there's basically, you know, no hope for her. She's going to suffer the rest of her life.
Well, you've been very interesting in describing sinus problems and some of the latest thinking about those problems. You write not only as a journalist, you write from experience as well. What are some of the sinus problems you've had?
Oh, I was about 10 years ago, I couldn't breathe very well when I slept. And it wasn't that I was snoring. I was, I just couldn't breathe. I would wake up feeling not rested. So I went to see a doctor and he said, oh, you have a deviated septum. It needs to be fixed. So I had deviated septum surgery. And unfortunately, I got an operating room infection. He didn't treat me for the infection, which got worse and worse and worse. And I became pregnant, and then nobody would really treat me. And I was so ill. I had a sinus infection in every single one of my sinuses. I had a white blood count that was put me at risk for sepsis. And I wound up in the hospital, and another doctor took pity on me and literally saved my life. I was about 7 months pregnant and wound up in the hospital for 2 weeks on every IV drug you could possibly imagine. And since then, I've had three sinus surgeries to try to clean up the damage from that first really awful infection. And I'm what you call today a nasal cripple.
Gabrielle Glaser talking with Terry Gross. Glaser's new book is The Nose. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's interview with journalist Gabrielle Glaser. Her new book is about the history, the science, and the cultural significance of the nose.
Now, you've also done a lot of historical research about the nose and the sense of smell, and even about what certain medical beliefs used to be about odors and their connection to disease. What are some of the interesting, now out-of-date medical theories about the connection between odor and illness?
Well, during the years of the plague, obviously, the people thought that a bad smell was a portent of the coming plague. And in many cases, it was because, you know, people were decaying and dying all around. And the smell, apparently, that had overtaken most of the continent of Europe in the Middle Ages was really just an awful thing to even try to imagine. And the nose's function, actually, some of the most astonishing and frankly hilarious research that I ran across was what the nose represented in terms of illness. The ancient Dr. Galen thought that whenever we had a runny nose, whenever people had a runny nose, it was a sign of the brain percolating, and that the brain's, percolating juices sifting down to the noses would eventually cause the person's brain to seize and die. And in many cases, obviously, a cold would signal the end of a person's life. If somebody didn't get over it and they got sick, they got pneumonia, they would die. And certainly during the plague, people tried to ward the bad smells of the decay and the death off by protecting themselves with what there are some anthropologists and sociologists who call this olfactory bubbles. In other words, they would literally wash themselves with urine of healthy people to try to ward off the disease. So you can just imagine how...
Wait, what's the point of that? So the urine would smell so bad it would crowd out the other bad smells?
Right, it would ward off, precisely. It would crowd out the other bad smells. And doctors filled, you know, I'm sure you've seen those woodcuts of doctors in the Middle Ages. They wore a long black cape and a big beak that was filled with rosemary and thyme and lavender, which was thought to ward off the disease because it, you know, something that actually smelled good.
Well, the book that I want to see that you reference in your book, The Nose, is an 1897 book called The Relationship Between the Nose and a Woman's Genitalia. What is that book about?
Oh, that was Wilhelm Fliess's book. He was a contemporary and friend of Sigmund Freud's, and he had this theory that women had something, and men had something called genital spots in their noses, and that if you didn't satisfy yourself sexually in the proper way in quotes, which is to say if you used condoms, if you masturbated, if you had too much sex or too little sex, your nose would, these genital spots would become engorged and cause you no end of nasal grief. And his theory was that if you operated on the nose and you took out the turbinates, which got engorged and apparently held these genital spots, then a person would be fine. And one of Freud's early analytical patients was a woman named Emma Eckstein. And she had many troubles. She had stomach problems. She had painful menstrual periods. And she went to Freud. And in addition to her other physical problems, Freud was convinced that one of her greatest ailments, she had nasal problems too. One of the greatest causes of all of her problems was that she masturbated. So in order to stop this incredible vice, which is what they called it in those days, he summoned Fliess to perform the surgery. Fliess was in Berlin, and he summoned Fliess to Vienna to perform the surgery, and Fliess left almost immediately afterwards. And this poor Emma Eckstein became sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And finally, weeks after the initial surgery, they pulled out, this is really gross, but they pulled out a half meter of gauze that had been left in her sinus cavities in the initial operation. And she had begun to stink. And Freud was writing desperately to Fliess, she stinks. What can we do? She has a fetid odor. And it turned out to be this gauze that they'd left in her nose, which became very infected, obviously.
Well, I'm sure the surgery succeeded in ruining whatever sex drive that she had.
Well, indeed. In fact, she had three more surgeries, if you can believe, two more surgeries, if you can believe that. And she had the nasal procedures that they performed on her. Ultimately, she was a really pretty girl when she was, you know, just a young woman, 19 years old, I think, when she first saw her, maybe early 20s. And her bones, the bones in her face, really caved in, and she became disfigured.
Wow, terrible story. Now, I just have to get back to something you brought up very early in the interview, which is that we produce somewhere between a pint and a quart of mucus a day.
Mm-hmm.
Where does all of it go, and what do we do with all of that?
Well, if your sinuses work and everything is working, you don't notice it. It's like saliva. You don't notice your mouth gathering saliva. It just passes from your sinuses back at the very back of your throat, and you swallow it, and it goes into your stomach. And that's all there is. But you do notice it if you're sick and it pools up and you can't blow your nose properly, or you do blow your nose all the time because you're trying to get it out of your nose. And so the short answer is either in a Kleenex or in your stomach.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about the nose.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Gabrielle Glaser's new book is The Nose, A Profile of Sex, Beauty, and Survival. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It takes more than talent to succeed. It takes the ability to handle success. Soul singer James Carr had more than enough talent to be one of the great voices of his time, but he also had demons holding him back. Ed Ward tells us the tragic story of a man for whom soul was not enough.
Hot just like fire, ever burning my eyes, just like the moonlight that forever shines. You are in my What a lovable girl. What a lovable girl. Your loving heart.
When the soul singer James Carr died in January of 2001, a part of me was glad. Carr's long struggle with himself was finally over, and so were the many frustrations for his friend Roosevelt Jameson, who had devoted a large part of his life trying to prove to the world that James Carr was one of the greatest soul singers of all time. Few people, however, have ever heard of Carr, which is a shame, because probably the only male vocalist who was his equal was Otis Redding. Carr never had access to the Stax Records family of studio musicians and songwriters like Otis did, but he did just fine with what he had at hand.
These ain't raindrops in my eye, just look at me. I wonder why can't you see me? Just one kiss would do so much. It would drive away all my fear. These ain't raindrops in my eyes. They are tears. Oh, oh.
James Carr was born in 1942 in Coahoma, Mississippi. But his family soon moved to Memphis, where James started singing in church at the age of six. That's where Roosevelt Jameson, a budding songwriter, first saw him, and he knew he had to get this guy recorded. In 1963, Quinton Clonch, a white Memphis guitarist who'd recorded with Carl Perkins on Sun, started a soul label called Gold Wax to compete with Stax. And it was to his house that Jameson dragged James Carr one night. He played Clonch some demos he'd made with Carr, and Clonch called his lawyer and asked him to have a contract ready the next morning. They hit gold with their third single.
I said I wasn't gonna tell nobody else, but I just can't keep it low to myself now. For as long as I've been running around, I finally met a little girl that really got me down now. Got my mind messed up now. Little girl,
you sure got my mind messed up now. I go to bed, Lord, and I can't sleep. Sit down at the table, ooh, Lord, I can't eat that. Somebody please, sir. Please help me now. Oh, 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 oh.
At the time, nobody realized quite how prophetic those lyrics were. They were too excited about another track that they had released as soon as You've Got My Mind Messed Up finally slid down the charts. It had been written by Carr's engineer, Chips Moman, and another white kid, Dan Penn, who wound up singing the harmony vocals on the chorus.
At the dark end of the street, that's where we always meet, hiding. Where we don't belong, living in darkness to hide our wrong. You and me at the dark end of the street. You and me. I know time.
Amazingly, although the song went into the soul top 10, it fizzled as a pop hit in early 1967. Most people know it through Aretha Franklin's version, which wasn't even a single. Carr's, however, remains one of the most perfect soul records ever made, although several others of his come close.
You push me when I'm falling, and you kick me when I'm down. I guess I missed my calling, 'cause I should have been a clown.
But after Dark End of the Street, the hits stopped coming. Carr himself was very unhappy with the fact that it hadn't done better, and this seemed to make the occasional spells of depression he'd always had seem worse. He began smoking a lot of pot and acting odd. He'd come to the studio, sit down, and not talk or move for a couple of hours, then suddenly stand up and deliver a masterpiece. Finally, Roosevelt Jameson turned Carr's management over to Phil Walden, who'd managed Otis Redding, and Quentin Clunch decided he'd release him from his record contract. Walden managed to get him one more single on Atlantic, but it wasn't very good and didn't go anywhere. What happened next? Nobody's quite sure. When a British fan interviewed him in 1987, Carr himself couldn't account for the years 1971 to 77, although he ended that period in a Florida jail where Jameson found him and got him on antidepressant medication. He also arranged for a Japanese tour, which ended when Carr took too much of his medication, walked on stage, and just stared at the lights. Carr rallied for a while, but after he had a cancerous lung removed in 1997, he stopped taking his medication again, and one of his sisters had him committed to a mental hospital. Finally, he moved to a nursing home and died, and his mind was no longer messed up.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Coming up, Tony Bennett and Katie Lang. This is Fresh Air.